Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hi, this is Ishleen. I'm the producer of the BBC World Service podcast, My Indian Life. And I just wanted to let you know that the whole of our second season is now available. From the story of the man who's desperate to be the first person on Mars, to the Kashmiri rapper making music under curfew. You'll find those and lots more brilliant stories from young people across India by searching for My Indian Life wherever you get your podcasts. Bye.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and we're recording this at 14 hours GMT on Tuesday, the 4th of February. Our main stories: UN health experts say the China coronavirus outbreak is not a pandemic, even though it's spread to more than 20 countries. The Democrats get off to a bad start in the US presidential race as the first results are delayed. And a South African court issues an arrest warrant for former President Jacob Zuma. Also in this podcast, we remember Kenya's longtime leader, Daniel Arap Moi, who's died at the age of 95.
As a person, he had pros and cons, but I don't have to remember I don't have to magnify the negative.
He was a great leader. He was not tribal.
The folk musicians in Sweden worried that their culture is being appropriated by the far right, and why Georgia wants to restore a former Soviet spa turned refugee shelter. Although the coronavirus outbreak in China has now spread to at least 23 countries, the World Health Organization says it is not currently a global pandemic. The UN agency has also warned against spreading misinformation. The virus has killed at least 425 people and infected more than 20,000, the vast majority in China. Our Geneva correspondent Imogen Folkes spoke to the WHO's Director of Global Infectious Hazard Preparedness, Dr. Sylvie Briand, about the danger of false rumours.
The impact of this misinformation will vary very much depending on location and the culture of the people and the health literacy they can have. And so it's kind of a monster with multiple faces and arms, and so it's really difficult to fight.
I'm going to give you a couple of examples that I've seen myself, people saying onions or black pepper can protect against the coronavirus.
So these are really, I would say, an harmful misinformation in a sense, because, it cannot harm if you eat more onions. And so we try to address these easily, and other misinformation can be harmful, and these are the ones we will target more specifically.
There's also been viral videos of people dropping down sick, apparently, in Wuhan, in supermarkets, on the street. Are these true? I mean, people are being very alarmed looking at these things.
Yeah, this is the power of the visual and the videos, and I cannot comment of what is true or what is not true, because we cannot verify all what is circulating on the web. But what we try is at least to make sure that we provide very regularly good information, so that people come to us as a trusted source of information, and then it can mitigate the impression or the fear they can have when they see those kind of video.
Okay, well, what does work then? Do face masks work?
So face masks, as I said, work for sick people. I think sick people need to wear masks because they are more likely to contaminate people in close contact because of the droplet transmission.
But healthy people, what should they be doing? I think this is what people want to know.
Okay, so healthy people, first people who have never been traveling to areas with ongoing transmission and who have never been in contact with potentially cases of this disease, healthy people should be reassured. But what they should do is they take simple measures like respiratory etiquette. If they are sick, they need, especially because we have flu ongoing at the moment, they need to stay home and take care of their health, and they need to wash their hands very often so that they prevent further transmission of any kind of respiratory viruses.
Do you think stopping flights to China is a good idea?
So this is not the recommendation of WHO. We have recommended that there is no travel ban. We are discussing with each country to see with them what is their assessment of the risk and to try to put in place measures that are commensurate to this risk assessment.
How dangerous do you think it is? I know it's early days, but how dangerous is this virus?
So we are assessing three things. First thing is the transmissibility, second thing is the severity, and the third thing is the impact. Regarding the transmissibility, we don't have all the evidence yet, but we can say that this virus is between, let's say, SARS and flu. And so that's why we recommend the same precaution as for flu and SARS, so that people are protected. Regarding the severity, currently the severity is still being assessed. We have early cases that have severe disease and have died, but currently most at-risk group are elderly and people with underlying conditions. So we will give more information as we know this. And so the people in this category need to have extra precaution, but only if they have been exposed to the virus.
Dr. Sylvie Briand of the WHO in Geneva. The first stage in the race to choose a Democratic presidential candidate has been an unmitigated disaster, according to a tweet from President Trump. He may have a biased view, of course, but he is correct when he says that Trump is the only person who can claim victory in Iowa. And that is because he easily won the Republican contest in the Iowa caucuses, while the Democratic results were delayed by what the party called a reporting issue. From the Iowan state capital, Des Moines, Neda Taufik sent us this report.
Iowa was supposed to set the tone and direction of the 2020 presidential race. Instead, it's thrown the Democratic Party into chaos.
It is too close to call, so I'm just going to tell you what I do know.
You won!
Well, the Iowa Democratic Party is working to get this result, get them straight.
After a long night of waiting, candidates including Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden told supporters that the long-anticipated result of the state's caucus would be delayed. Party officials explained in a statement that there were inconsistencies in the initial count, and some county chairs reported that the app used to submit data failed.
And I want to make sure they're very careful in their deliberations.
Still, there was a rush to declare victory, even if unofficially.
Have a strong feeling that at some point the results will be announced. And when those results are announced, I have a good feeling we're going to be doing very, very well here in Iowa.
Senator Bernie Sanders has energized young voters and progressives in the party. His campaign said their own data from nearly 40% of precincts showed he was in the lead.
So we don't know all the results, but we know by the time it's all said and done, Iowa, you have shocked the nation.
But Pete Buttigieg, a moderate who wants to be America's first gay president, believes he's in a position to win the most of Iowa's 41 delegates.
By all indications, we are going on to New Hampshire victorious.
The Iowa Democratic Party is in the process of manually verifying the results and says they will be released later Tuesday. While Democrats were twitching, President Trump was tweeting, "Big win for us in Iowa," he wrote. And his team wasted no time slamming the caucus debacle, calling it the sloppiest train wreck in history.
Did any of you guys do early check-in?
Earlier, Iowans gathered at 1,600 sites to select their choice to take on President Trump in the upcoming presidential election.
You can go ahead and fill out side one, which is the blue side of your presidential preference card.
At this museum in Urbandale, Iowa, the process wasn't so smooth, with a tie between Pete Buttigieg and Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar settled with a coin toss.
Heads.
Iowa's outcome may still be unclear, but the race and the candidates themselves have already moved on to New Hampshire for the next battle.
Neda Taufik in Iowa. For years, Jacob Zuma, former president of South Africa, has been dogged by corruption charges. Now he's been issued with an arrest warrant after failing to appear at a pre-trial hearing. The warrant will come into effect if he doesn't appear at the start of his trial in May. So what's going on? Our correspondent, Nomsa Maseko, is in Johannesburg.
Former President Jacob Zuma did not turn up because he's apparently sick and he is receiving medical treatment from outside of South Africa. Now, local media here is reporting that Mr. Zuma is in Cuba to receive medical treatment, but that is yet to be confirmed. So what happened in court is that his lawyer submitted a sick note to the court, but the medical certificate which was handed in was found to be inadmissible because there were some mistakes in it. There wasn't even a date. And the judge questioned whether the note was valid and because there was no medical number showing, or if the doctor who wrote the note is actually certified.
So his critics will be suspicious that he's not actually ill and he's just trying to get out of these charges.
Indeed. I mean, many of the critics are saying exactly that. But Mr. Zuma, who's made several attempts to have this case permanently dropped, has claimed that this case was there was a political conspiracy against him. And many from inside and outside the governing African National Congress, who have often accused Mr. Zuma of enabling corruption and widespread looting while he was still in power, are saying that Mr. Zuma must have his day in court.
Yeah, remind us of the charges that he's facing.
Well, Jacob Zuma faces 16 charges of fraud, corruption, racketeering and money laundering. And this is relating to a controversial multi-billion dollar arms deal, which is dating back to the 1990s. And in fact, this is 1999, the year Mr. Zuma moved from being a provincial minister to being deputy president. He's accused of also accepting 783 illegal payments from French arms company Thales through his former financial advisor, Mr. Shabir Sheikh, who was convicted in relation to the same charges back in 2005.
So his time in office is tainted, but is he still popular? Does he still have support in South Africa?
Well, normally when the former president appears in court, there are thousands of his supporters, including those from within the ANC and also the military veterans. But today they were urged not to come to court because they knew that Mr. Zuma would not be attending. So when he does hopefully go back to court on the 6th of May, his supporters will be there. But if he does not pitch for the beginning of the trial on the 6th of May, then the arrest warrant will come into force.
Nomsa Maseko in Johannesburg. Kenya's longest-serving president has died at the age of 95. Daniel Arap Moi led the country for 24 years. Initially admired at home and abroad, he was later seen as an international pariah for presiding over systematic corruption and human rights violations. Nevertheless, a period of national mourning has been declared in Kenya.
It's sad to get the news that former President Moi has passed on. He was a great leader. He was not tribal. And we will miss his magnanimity and just a sense of caring for the welfare of others. May his soul rest in peace.
Concerning the death of the former President Moi, what I can remember about him is the milk he used to give to the pupil at a primary school and also his presidency, the way he ruled.
Our Deputy Africa Editor Anne Soy shared her thoughts from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
His legacy is mixed. I mean, it has taken 18 years for people to come to a sort of a consensus that he may actually have been a better president than some of his successors. But in 2002, when he was handing over power to Mwai Kibaki, I remember people throwing dirt at him. People were really fed up with his leadership. And that was because of the corruption that you mentioned earlier. Many people were tortured, especially the dissenting voices. But some of them, we saw, later came to seek his blessings before seeking political seats. So it's been a very mixed legacy for him. Somebody did mention about the milk that he gave to primary school children. I grew up in the 80s. That's when I was in primary school. And this was one of his strongest legacies, education. He made sure that every village had a primary school at least. I personally went to schools that were named after him right from primary to university. People remember his strong policies in education and conservation, although conservation was mixed.
Ultimately forced to stand down, as you say, in 2002, 18 years ago. Is his legacy still felt in Kenya?
Many 18-year-olds will not remember Moi the way we did. When I was growing up, we knew, we thought Moi was synonymous. I remember asking who was the Moi of Uganda. He was such a dominant figure. in Kenya. Locally, he was known as the professor of politics. And that is really about how he played the local politics. All his cabinet ministers were really afraid of him.
And Soy in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, on former President Daniel Arap Moi, who's died aged 95. Still to come in the podcast.
He considered buying an electric car. In the end, it was looking too expensive. I think next time he'd change car, he'll buy an electric car.
Off the road, Britain plans to ban new petrol, diesel and even hybrid vehicles. Despite past ties to neo-Nazis, the nationalist Sweden Democrats are riding a wave of popularity. The party claims to represent traditional Swedish folk culture, but some musicians there disagree and are challenging that view. Matilda Veiling reports from the Swedish capital, Stockholm.
Yeah, welcome to Enskede, to my studio.
I am in the Stockholm studio of folk musician Elinor Fritz. Elinor is a highly acclaimed fiddle player. She was shocked when she first encountered abuse on the street for wearing her traditional folklore dress.
It happened in 2011, and I was walking through the streets of Örebro wearing my folk dress when I heard a person shouting after me, "Oh, I'm a Sweden Democrat." And I just, "What?"
Elinor discovered a photograph of her wearing her traditional dress had appeared in a right-wing newsletter.
And I was very sad because I don't want to be associated with nationalism or racism. My folk dress represents diversity and you should be proud of your background, but it has nothing to do with nationalism to me.
Over the last decade, as nationalist parties such as the Sweden Democrats have grown, their supporters have harnessed traditional Swedish images and music to represent them. But folk dancers and musicians have been fighting back.
My name is Sara Parkman. I am a folk musician and a composer and artist.
Sara Parkman helped form Musicians Against Racism. The trigger was 2010, when the Sweden Democrats entered parliament for the first time, and the leader, Jimmy Åkesson, chose to wear traditional costume, which he had hired from a museum.
It felt like he really wanted to appropriate the Swedish folklore culture because he has hired the dress. It was not like his mother who made it for him or something. And there were so many people who were just like, he's taking our symbols, and so if I am using these folklorical dresses, are people going to think that I'm a racist now or a nationalist?
The group started writing articles, hosting discussions, and also playing gigs outside metro stations, always dressed in traditional costume. Culture conservation groups say that political parties, such as the Sweden Democrats, have every right to use folk music and costume to promote traditional Swedish values. But artists, like Elinor, say they will continue the campaign to make sure their music is for everyone.
That report from Sweden by Matilda Veiling. 15 years from now, people in Britain will not be able to buy new petrol, diesel and even hybrid cars under government plans to bring forward a ban to 2035. Experts said the original cut-off date of 2040 would leave too many polluting vehicles on the road. At the moment, fully electric cars represent less than 1% of new sales. These drivers expressed doubts about going electric.
Where are you going to charge them? My neighbour has an electric car. He can't charge it nowhere.
Yes, we've recently considered buying an electric car, but in the end it was looking too expensive. So I think next time we change car, we'll buy an electric car. The bigger reward is, you know, cheaper travel for me and feeling that I'm no longer driving my filthy diesel around.
Mixed opinions there, but environmentalists say the government's proposals don't go far enough. Leo Murray is from the climate change charity Possible.
We also need to get people out of cars. This isn't just a job of switching the engines in our cars for cleaner engines. There are 35 odd million petrol and diesel vehicles on the roads in the UK. And the idea that 35 million new cars and vans is the right environmental solution to an unfolding crisis, lots of people will look at that and go, that doesn't seem right. You know, there are issues around where we source the raw materials for the batteries and so on. We probably cannot scale up the supply chain fast enough to just swap every car on the roads. But of course, if you look at places like London, you know, our major cities in the UK, transport planners have known for a long time that cities are better places to live with improved quality of life for people, the fewer private cars there are. So what we really need from government is action to get people out of their cars. There's lots of European countries that are doing this. Now, Norway is a leader. Oslo is in the process of completely removing private cars from its city centre. Now, Oslo is not London. It's a much, much smaller capital city. But if you talk to Norwegian policymakers about their journey and their successes in electric vehicles, what they will say is, we offer too much carrot and not enough stick. And actually, they wound up with, yes, they've got more EVs on the road than anybody else per citizen, but some people that used to ride bikes are now in electric vehicles. So we can do this.
Climate change campaigner Leo Murray. The Georgian government has announced plans to revive an abandoned spa town, once one of the most desirable holiday destinations for Soviet workers and a favourite haunt of communist dictator Joseph Stalin. The Grand Spa hotels in Georgia fell into disrepair after the collapse of the Soviet Union. But as Rehan Dimitri reports, they're now providing shelter for thousands of Georgians displaced by conflict.
Two boys are kicking a football around a magnificent but shabby entrance hall. The parquet floor is battered and broken. Above them, a giant crystal chandelier still hangs from the ceiling. This is one of 22 abandoned Soviet spa hotels, known as sanatoriums, in the western Georgian town of Tsakhaltubo, and little luxury remains for its current inhabitants. Rusudan Khurtidze has been living in this building since 1992. Back then, she was among tens of thousands of Georgians forced from their homes in the civil war over the separatist region of Abkhazia. Many families were given shelter in the empty hotel rooms. The accommodation, they were told, would be temporary.
It's not a great place to bring up children. Water pipes were installed only a year ago. Before that, we used to bring water from downstairs. There are only two rooms with bathrooms. The rest of us use communal toilets. I cannot get dressed or undressed living in one room with my son.
The Georgian government has relocated most of the 12,000 refugees originally housed in Tsakhaltubo. About 5,000 people are still waiting to move out, says Leyla Ashordia, a former refugee herself. Leyla now runs a charity called Acting Together, which supports the refugee families.
For a very long time, many of us were thinking that today or tomorrow we will go back to our homes in Abkhazia. But this wait lasted for 27 years. A lot of people have left. Those who stay behind are waiting to be rehoused.
The leaking water pipes, the poverty amidst the former glory of the grand old hotels, creates a feeling of hopelessness in Tsakhaltubo. But it wasn't always like this. Tsakhaltubo was once a top holiday destination for Soviet workers, famous for its natural hot springs. The entire spa town was built because Joseph Stalin himself believed in the healing powers of the hot springs. The glory days of Tsakhaltubo ended with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the civil war that followed. Now there are plans to invest millions of dollars into the restoration of the spa hotels. But first, their permanent guests must be resettled. Until then, Tsakhaltubo will remain a relic of the Soviet past and a home for the homeless.
Rehan Dimitri reporting from Georgia. Last week, a brand new batch of emojis was unveiled, including men in wedding dresses, a fondue pot and a gender-neutral Santa Claus. But the one that seems to have got everyone talking is a set of pinched fingers, apparently symbolising a common Italian hand gesture, as Siobhan Leahy reports.
This gesture will be familiar to anyone who's ever interacted with an Italian. It's usually performed while flicking the wrist up and down, and the creators of this emoji claim it represents the way an Italian might ask, "Ma che vuoi?" meaning, "What do you want?" Italians and the diaspora have been rejoicing online since the emoji was approved. A tweet by comedian Jabuki Young White reading, "Italians, we won," has almost a million likes, while the official account for the US state of New Jersey, home to many Italian Americans, simply tweeted, "Endorsed." But depending on where you are in the world, this particular configuration of holding the fingers and thumb together could have a completely different meaning. And social media users have been quick to point out those differing interpretations. For example, in the Arab world, you might use it if you're asking someone to calm down or be patient. In Nigeria, it was suggested that the gesture could be the emoji version of "gabas gabos," a back and forth argument. The K-pop star Yuri uses the gesture to tell fans she loves them. And in India, it can be a way of asking if someone's hungry. In fact, one user wrote, "You see an Italian hand gesture. I see a Gujarati person eating dal bhat rotli shak."
Siobhan Leahy. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on the podcast or anything in it, send an email to globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.